13. Star-crossed. London, England. June 29, 1613. Something crunched under Luce's feet. She raised the hem of her black gown. A layer of discarded walnut shells on the ground was so thick, the stringy brown bits rose up over the buckles of her emerald-green high-heeled slippers. She was at the rear of a noisy crowd of people. Almost everyone around her was dressed in muted browns or grays, the women in long gowns with ruched bodices and wide cuffs at the ends of their bell sleeves. The men wore tapered pants, broad mantles draping their shoulders, and flat caps made of wool. She'd never stepped out of an announcer into such a public place before, but here she was, in the middle of a packed amphitheater. It was startling and riotously loud.
"Look out!"
Bill grabbed the back of her velvet capelet and yanked her backward, pinning her against the wooden rail of a staircase. A heartbeat later, two grimy boys barreled past in a reckless game of tag that sent a trio of women in their path falling over one another. The women heaved themselves back up and shouted curses at the boys, who jeered back, barely slowing down.
"Next time,"
Bill shouted in her ear, cupping his stone claws around his mouth.
"Could you try directing your little stepping-through exercises into a more, I don't know, serene setting? How am I supposed to do your costuming in the middle of this mob?"
"Sure, Bill, I'll work on that." Luce edged back just as the boys playing tag zipped by again. "Where are we?"
"You've circled the globe to find yourself in the globe, m'lady."
Bill sketched a little bow. "The Globe Theater?" Luce ducked as the woman in front of her discarded a gnawed-on turkey leg by tossing it over her shoulder.
"You mean, like, Shakespeare?"
"Well, he claims to be retired. You know those artist types. So moody."
Bill swooped down near the ground, tugging at the hem of her dress and humming to himself.
"Othello happened here," Luce said, taking a moment to let it all sink in. "The Tempest? Romeo and Juliet? We're practically standing in the center of all the greatest love stories ever written."
"Actually, you're standing in walnut shells."
"Why do you have to be so glib about everything? This is amazing."
"Sorry, I didn't realize we'd need a moment of bardolatry."
His words came out lisp because of the needle clipped between his jagged teeth.
"Now stand still."
"Ouch!"
Luce yelped as he jabbed sharply into her kneecap.
"What are you doing?"
"I'm anachronizing you. These folks will pay good money for a freak show, but they're expecting it to stay on stage."
Bill worked quickly, discreetly tucking the long, draped fabric of her black gown from Versailles into a series of folds and crimps so that it was gathered along the sides. He knocked away her black wig and pulled her hair into a frizzy poof. Then he eyed the velvet capelet around her shoulders. He whipped off the soft fabric. At last, he hawked a giant loogie into one hand, rubbed his palms together, and welded the capelet into a high Jacobean collar.
"That is seriously disgusting, Bill."
"Be quiet," he snapped. "Next time, give me more space to work. You think I like making do?" "I don't."
He jerked his head at the jeering throngs.
"Luckily, most of them are too drunk to notice the girls stepping out of the shadows at the back of the room."
Bill was right. No one was looking at them. Everyone was squabbling as they pressed closer to the stage. It was just a platform, raised about 5 feet off the ground, and, standing at the back of the rowdy crowd, Luce had trouble seeing it clearly.
"Come on now," a boy shouted from the back. "Don't make us wait all day."
Above the crowd were three tiers of box seats, and then nothing. The O-shaped amphitheater opened on a midday sky, the pale blue of a robin's egg. Luce looked around for her past self, for Daniel.
"We're at the opening of the globe."
She thought back to Daniel's words under the peach trees at Sword and Cross.
"Daniel told me we were here."
"Sure, you were here," Bill said. "About 14 years ago, perched on your older brother's shoulder. You came with your family to see Julius Caesar."
Bill hovered in the air a foot in front of her. It was unappetizing, but the high collar around her neck actually seemed to hold its shape. She almost resembled the sumptuously dressed women in the higher boxes.
"And Daniel?" she asked.
Daniel was a player. Hey, that's what they call the actors. Bill rolled his eyes. He was just starting out then. To everyone else in the audience, his debut was utterly forgettable. But to little 3-year-old Lucinda, Bill shrugged, it put the fire in you. You've been quote-unquote dying to get on stage ever since. Tonight's your night.
I'm an actor?
No, her friend Callie was the actor, not her. During Luce's last semester at the Dover School, Callie had begged Luce to try out with her for Our Town. The two of them had rehearsed for weeks before the audition. Luce got one line, but Callie had brought the house down with her portrayal of Emily Webb. Luce had watched from the wings, proud of and awed by her friend. Callie would have sold off her life's possessions to stand in the Old Globe Theater for 1 minute, let alone to get up on the stage. But then Luce remembered Callie's blood-drained face when she'd seen the angels battle the outcasts. What had happened to Callie after Luce had left? Where were the outcasts now? How would Luce ever explain to Callie, or her parents, what had happened? If, that is, Luce ever returned to her backyard and that life. Because Luce knew now that she wouldn't go back to that life until she'd figured out how to stop it from ending. Until she'd unraveled this curse that forced her and Daniel to live out the same star-crossed lover's tale again and again. She must be here in this theater for a reason. Her soul had drawn her here. Why? She pushed through the crowd, moving along the side of the amphitheater until she could see the stage. The wooden planks had been covered with a thick, hemp-like matting, made to look like rough grass. 2 full-sized cannons stood like guards near either wing, and a row of potted orange trees lined the back wall. Not far from Luce, a rickety wooden ladder led to a curtained space. The tiring room, she remembered from the acting class she'd taken with Callie, where the actors got into their costumes and prepared for their scenes.
Wait! Bill called as she hurried up the ladder.
Behind the curtain, the room was small and cramped and dimly lit. Luce passed stacks of manuscripts and open wardrobes full of costumes, ogling a massive lion's head mask and rows of hanging gold and velvet cloaks. Then she froze. Several actors were standing around in various stages of undress, boys with half-buttoned gowns, men lacing up brown leather boots. Thankfully, the actors were busily powdering their faces and frantically rehearsing lines so that the room was filled with short, shouted-out fragments of the play. Before any of the actors could look up and see her, Bill flew to Luce's side and pushed her into one of the wardrobes. Clothes closed around her.
"What are you doing?" she asked.
"Let me remind you that you're an actor in a time when there are no actresses." Bill frowned. "You don't belong back here as a woman. Not that that stopped you. Your past self took some pretty grand risks to get herself a role in All Is True."
"All Is True?" Luce repeated. She'd been hoping she would at least recognize the title. No such luck. She peeked out of the wardrobe into the room.
"You know it as Henry VIII," Bill said, yanking her back by the collar. "But pay attention. Would you like to venture a guess as to why your past self would lie and disguise herself to land a role?"
"Daniel."
He'd just come into the tiring room. The door to the yard outside was still open behind him. The sun was at his back. Daniel walked alone, reading a handwritten script, hardly noticing the other players around him. He looked different than he had in any of her other lives. His blonde hair was long and a bit wavy, gathered with a black band at the nape of his neck. He had a beard, neatly trimmed, just a bit darker in color than the hair on his head. Luce felt an urge to touch it, to caress his face and run her fingers through his hair and trace the back of his neck and touch every part of him. His white shirt gaped open, showing the clean line of muscles on his chest. His black pants were baggy, gathered into knee-high black boots. As he drew nearer, her heart began to pound. The roar of the crowd in the pit fell away. The stink of dried sweat from the costumes in the wardrobe disappeared. There was just the sound of her breathing and his footsteps moving toward her. She stepped out of the wardrobe. At the sight of her, Daniel's thunderstorm gray eyes glowed violet. He smiled in surprise. She couldn't hold it in any longer.
She rushed toward him, forgetting Bill, forgetting the actors, forgetting the past self, who could be anywhere, steps away, the girl this Daniel really belonged to. She forgot everything but her need to be held by him. He slid his arms easily around her waist, guiding her quickly to the other side of the bulky wardrobe, where they were hidden from the other actors. Her hands found the back of his neck. A warm rush rippled through her. She closed her eyes and felt his lips come down on hers, feather light, almost too light. She waited to feel the hunger in his kiss. She waited and waited. Luce inched higher, arching her neck so that he would kiss her harder, more deeply. She needed his kiss to remind her why she was doing this, losing herself in the past and seeing herself dying again and again, because of him, because of the two of them together, because of their love. Touching him again reminded her of Versailles. She wanted to thank him for saving her from marrying the king, and to beg him never to hurt himself again, as he'd done in Tibet. She wanted to ask what he dreamed about when he'd slept for days after she died in Prussia. She wanted to hear what he'd said to Lushka right before she died that awful night in Moscow. She wanted to pour out her love and break down and cry and let him know that every second of every lifetime she'd been through, she had missed him with all her heart. But there was no way to communicate any of that to this Daniel. None of that had even happened yet to this Daniel. Besides, he took her for the Lucinda of this era, the girl who didn't know any of the things that Luce had come to know. There were no words to tell him. Her kiss was the only way she could show him that she understood. But Daniel wouldn't kiss her the way she wanted. The closer she pressed to him, the farther back he leaned. Finally, he pushed her away completely. He held on only to her hands, as if the rest of her were dangerous.
"Lady."
He kissed the very tips of her fingers, making her shiver.
"Would I be too bold to say your love makes you unmannerly?"
"Unmannerly?" Luce blushed. Daniel took her back into his arms, slowly, a bit nervously.
"Good, Lucinda. You must not find yourself in this place dressed as you are."
His eyes kept returning to her dress.
"What clothes are these? Where is your costume?"
He reached into a wardrobe and flicked through the clothes bags. Quickly, Daniel began to unlace his boots, tossing them on the floor with two thuds. Luce tried not to gape when he dropped his trousers. He wore short gray pantaloons underneath that left very little to the imagination. Her cheeks burned as Daniel briskly unbuttoned his white shirt. He yanked it off, exposing the full beauty of his chest. Luce sucked in her breath. The only things missing were his unfurled wings. Daniel was so impeccably gorgeous, and he seemed to have no idea of the effect he was having on her by standing there in his underwear. She gulped, fanning herself.
"Is it hot in here?"
"Put these on until I can fetch your costume," he said, tossing the clothes at her. "Hurry, before someone sees you."
He dashed to the wardrobe in the corner and rifled through it, pulling out a rich green and gold robe, another white shirt, and a pair of cropped green pants. He hurried into the new clothes. His costume, Luce guessed, as she picked up his discarded street clothes. Luce remembered that it had taken the servant girl in Versailles a half hour to squeeze her into this dress. There were strings and ties and laces and all sorts of private places. There was no way she was going to be able to get out of it with any sort of dignity.
"There was, a costume change."
Luce gripped the black fabric of her skirt.
"I thought this would look nice for my character."
Luce heard footsteps behind her, but before she could turn, Daniel's hand pulled her deep into the wardrobe next to him. It was cramped and dark and wonderful to be so close. He pulled the door shut as far as it would go and stood before her, looking like a king with a green and gold robe wrapped around him. He raised an eyebrow.
"Where did you get this? Is our Anne Boleyn suddenly from Mars?"
He chuckled.
"I always thought she hailed from Wiltshire."
Luce's mind raced to catch up. She was playing Anne Boleyn? She'd never read this play, but Daniel's costume suggested he was playing the king, Henry VIII.
"Mr. Shakespeare, Will, thought it would look good."
"Oh, Will did."
Daniel smirked, not believing her at all, but seeming not to care. It was strange to feel that she could do or say almost anything, and Daniel would still find it charming.
"You're a little bit mad, aren't you, Lucinda?"
Well... He brushed her cheek with the back of his finger.
"I adore you."
"I adore you, too." The words tumbled from her mouth, feeling so real and so true after the last few stammering lies. It was like letting out a long-held breath. "I've been thinking a lot, and I wanted to tell you that...
"Yes?"
"The truth is that what I feel for you is deeper than adoration." She pressed her hands over his heart. "I trust you. I trust your love. I know now how strong it is and how beautiful." Luce knew that she couldn't come right out and say what she really meant. She was supposed to be a different version of herself, and the other times, when Daniel had figured out who she was, where she'd come from, he'd clammed up immediately and told her to leave. But maybe if she chose her words carefully, Daniel would understand. "It may seem like sometimes I forget what you mean to me and what I mean to you, but deep down, I know. I know because we are meant to be together. I love you, Daniel." Daniel looked shocked.
You love me?"
"Of course." Luce almost laughed at how obvious it was, but then she remembered. She had no idea which moment from her past she'd walked into. Maybe in this lifetime they'd only exchanged coy glances. Daniel's chest rose and fell violently, and his lower lip began to quiver.
"I want you to come away with me," he said quickly.
There was a desperate edge to his voice. Luce wanted to cry out, "Yes," but something held her back. It was so easy to get lost in Daniel when his body was pressed so close to hers and she could feel the heat coming off his skin and the beating of his heart through his shirt. She felt she could tell him anything now, from how glorious it had felt to die in his arms in Versailles to how devastated she was now that she knew the scope of his suffering. But she held back. The girl he thought she was in this lifetime wouldn't talk about those things, wouldn't know about them. Neither would Daniel. So when she finally opened her mouth, her voice faltered. Daniel put a finger over her lips.
"Wait, don't protest yet. Let me ask you properly. By and by, my love."
He peeked out the cracked wardrobe door toward the curtain. A cheer came from the stage. The audience roared with laughter and applause. Luce hadn't even realized the play had begun.
"That's my entrance. I'll see you soon."
He kissed her forehead, then dashed out and onto the stage. Luce wanted to run after him, but two figures came and stood just beyond the wardrobe door. The door squeaked open, and Bill fluttered inside.
"You're getting good at this," he said, flopping onto a sack of old wigs.
"Where have you been hiding?"
"Who, me? Nowhere. What would I have to hide from?" he asked. "That little costume change sham was a wee stroke of genius," he said, raising his tiny hand for a high five. It was always a bit of a buzzkill to be reminded that Bill was a fly on the wall during every interaction with Daniel.
"You're really going to leave me hanging like this?"
Bill slowly withdrew his hand. Luce ignored him. Something felt heavy and raw in her chest. She kept hearing the desperation in Daniel's voice when he'd asked her to run away with him. What had that meant? "I'm dying tonight, aren't I, Bill?"
"Well..." Bill cast his eyes down. "Yes."
Luce swallowed hard. "Where's Lucinda? I need to get inside her again so I can understand this lifetime." She pushed at the wardrobe door, but Bill took hold of the sash on her gown and pulled her back.
"Look, kid, going 3D can't be your go-to move. Think of it as a special occasion skill."
He pursed his lips.
"What is it you think you're going to learn here?"
"What she needs to escape from, of course," Luce said. "What is Daniel saving her from? Is she engaged to someone else? Living with a cruel uncle? Out of favor with the king?"
"Uh-oh."
Bill scratched the top of his head. It made a grating sound, like nails on a chalkboard.
I must have made a pedagogical boo-boo somewhere. You think there's a reason for your death every time?
There's not. She could feel her face fall.
I mean, your deaths aren't meaningless, exactly.
But when I died inside Lee, I felt everything. She believed that burning up freed her. She was happy, because marrying that king would have meant her life was a lie, and Daniel could save her by killing her.
Oh, honey, is that what you think? That your deaths are an out for bad marriages or something?
She squeezed her eyes shut against the sting of sudden tears. It has to be something like that. It has to be. Otherwise, it's just pointless.
It's not pointless, Bill said. You do die for a reason. Just not so simple a reason. You can't expect to understand it all at once.
She grunted in frustration and banged her fist against the side of the wardrobe.
I can see what you're all jacked up about, Bill said finally. You went 3D, and you think you unlocked the secret of your universe. But it's not always that neat and easy. Expect chaos. Embrace chaos. You should still try to learn as much as you can from every life you visit. Maybe in the end, it'll all add up to something. Maybe you'll end up with Daniel. Or maybe you'll decide there's more to life than...
A rustling startled them. Luce peeked around the wardrobe door. A man, around 50, with a salt-and-pepper goatee and a small potbelly, stood just behind an actor in a dress. They were whispering. When the girl turned her head a little, the stage lights lit up her profile. Luce froze at the sight. A delicate nose and small lips made up with pink powder. A dark brown wig, with just a few strands of long black hair showing underneath. A gorgeous golden gown. It was Lucinda, fully costumed as Anne Boleyn, and about to go on stage. Luce edged out of the wardrobe. She felt nervous and tongue-tied, but also oddly empowered. If what Bill had told her was true, there wasn't a lot of time left.
"Bill," she whispered, "I need you to do that thing where you press pause so I can..."
"Shh!"
Bill's hiss had a finality that said Luce was on her own. She would just have to wait until this man left so she could get Lucinda alone. Unexpectedly, Lucinda moved toward the wardrobe where Luce was hiding. Lucinda reached inside. Her hand moved toward the golden cloak right next to Luce's shoulder. Luce held her breath, reached up, clasped her fingers with Lucinda's. Lucinda gasped and threw the door wide, staring deep into Luce's eyes, teetering on the edge of some inexplicable understanding. The floor beneath them seemed to tilt. Luce grew dizzy, closing her eyes and feeling as if her soul had dropped out of her body. She saw herself from the outside, her strange dress that Bill had altered on the fly, the raw fear in her eyes. The hand in hers was soft, so soft she could barely feel it. She blinked, and Lucinda blinked, and then Luce didn't feel any hand at all. When she looked down, her hand was empty. She'd become the girl she'd been holding on to. Quickly, she grabbed the cloak and settled it over her shoulders. The only other person in the tiring room was the man who'd been whispering to Lucinda. Lucinda knew then that he was William Shakespeare. William Shakespeare! She knew him. They were, the three of them, Lucinda, Daniel, and Shakespeare, friends. There had been a summer afternoon when Daniel had taken Lucinda to visit Shakespeare at his home in Stratford. Toward sunset, they'd sat in the library, and while Daniel worked on his sketches at the window, Will had asked her question after question, all the while taking furious notes, about when she'd first met Daniel, how she felt about him, whether she thought she could one day fall in love. Aside from Daniel, Shakespeare was the only one who knew the secret of Lucinda's identity, her gender, and the love the players shared offstage. In exchange for his discretion, Lucinda was keeping the secret that Shakespeare was present that night at the Globe. Everyone else in the company assumed that he was in Stratford, that he'd handed over the reins of the theater to Master Fletcher. Instead, Will appeared incognito to see the play's opening night. When she returned to his side, Shakespeare gazed deep into Lucinda's eyes.
"You've changed."
"I... no, I'm still..."
She felt the soft brocade around her shoulders.
"Yes, I found the cloak."
"The cloak, is it?"
He smiled at her, winked.
It suits you.
Then Shakespeare put his hand on Lucinda's shoulder, the way he always did when he was giving directorial instructions.
Hear this. Everyone here already knows your story. They'll see you in this scene, and you won't say or do very much. But Anne Boleyn is a rising star in the court. Every one of them has a stake in your destiny.
He swallowed.
As well, don't forget to hit the mark at the end of your line. You need to be downstage left for the start of the dance.
Luce could feel her lines in the play run across her mind. The words would be there when she needed them, when she stepped on stage in front of all these people. She was ready. The audience roared and applauded again. A rush of actors exited the stage and filled the space around her. Shakespeare had already slipped away. She could see Daniel on the opposite wing of the stage. He towered over the other actors, regal and impossibly gorgeous. It was her cue to walk on stage. This was the start of the party scene at Lord Wolsey's estate, where the king, Daniel, would perform an elaborate mask before taking Anne Boleyn's hand for the first time. They were supposed to dance and fall heavily in love. It was supposed to be the very beginning of a romance that changed everything. The beginning. But for Daniel, it wasn't the beginning at all. For Lucinda, however, and for the character she was playing, it was love at first sight. Laying eyes on Daniel had felt like the first real thing ever to happen to Lucinda, just as it had felt for Luce at Sword and Cross. Her whole world had suddenly meant something in a way it never had before. Luce could not believe how many people were crowded into the globe. They were practically on top of the actors, pressed so close to the stage in the pit that at least 20 spectators had their elbows propped up on the stage itself. She could smell them. She could hear them breathing. And yet, somehow, Luce felt calm, even energized, as if, instead of panicking under all this attention, Lucinda was coming to life. It was a party scene. Luce was surrounded by Anne Boleyn's ladies-in-waiting. She almost laughed at how comical her ladies looked around her. These teen boys' Adam's apples bobbed obviously under the glare of the stage lanterns. Sweat formed rings under the arms of their padded dresses. Across the stage, Daniel and his court stood watching her unabashedly, his love plain on his face. She played her part effortlessly, sneaking just enough admiring glances at Daniel to pique both his and the audience's interest. She even improvised a move, pulling her hair away from her long, pale neck, that gave a foreboding hint of what everyone knew awaited the real Anne Boleyn. Two players drew close, flanking Luce. They were the noblemen of the play, Lord Sands and Lord Wolsey.
"Ladies, you're not merry. Gentlemen, whose fault is this?"
Lord Wolsey's voice boomed. He was the host of the party, and the villain, and the actor playing him had incredible stage presence. Then he turned and swept his gaze around to look at Luce. She froze. Lord Wolsey was being played by Cam. There was no space for Luce to shout, curse, or flee. She was a professional actor now, so she stayed collected and turned to Wolsey's companion, Lord Sands, who delivered his lines with a laugh.
"The red wine first must rise in their fair cheeks, my lord," he said.
When it was Lucinda's turn to deliver her line, her body trembled, and she sneaked a peek at Daniel. His violet eyes smoothed over the roughness she felt. He believed in her.
"You are a merry gamester, my Lord Sands," Luce felt herself say loudly in a perfectly pitched, teasing tone.
Then Daniel stepped forward, and a trumpet sounded, followed by a drum. The dance was beginning. He took her hand. When he spoke to her, not to the audience, as the other players did.
"The fairest hand I ever touched," Daniel said. "Oh, beauty, till now I never knew thee."
As if the lines had been written for the two of them. They began to dance, and Daniel locked eyes with her the whole time. His eyes were crystal clear and violet, and the way they never strayed from hers chipped away at Luce's heart. She knew he'd loved her always, but until this moment, dancing with him on the stage in front of all these people, she'd never really thought about what it meant.
It meant that when she saw him for the first time in every life, Daniel was already in love with her. Every time. And always had been. And every time she had to fall in love with him from scratch. He could never pressure her or push her into loving him. He had to win her anew each time. Daniel's love for her was one long, uninterrupted stream. It was the purest form of love there was, purer even than the love Luce returned. His love flowed without breaking, without stopping. Whereas Luce's love was wiped clean with every death, Daniel's grew over time, across all eternity. How powerfully strong must it be by now? Hundreds of lifetimes of love stacked one on top of the other? It was almost too massive for Luce to comprehend. He loved her that much, and yet in every lifetime, over and over again, he had to wait for her to catch up. All this time they had been dancing with the rest of the troupe, bounding in and out of the wings at breaks in the music, coming back on stage for more gallantry, for longer sets with more ornate steps, until the whole company was dancing. At the close of the scene, even though it wasn't in the script, even though Cam was standing right there, watching, Luce held fast to Daniel's hand and pulled him to her, up against the potted orange trees. He looked at her like she was crazy, and tried to tug her to the mark dictated by her stage directions. "What are you doing?" he murmured. He had doubted her before, backstage when she tried to speak freely about her feelings. She had to make him believe her. Especially if Lucinda died tonight, understanding the depth of her love would mean everything to him. It would help him to carry on, to keep loving her for hundreds more years, through all the pain and hardship she'd witnessed, right up to the present. Luce knew that it wasn't in the script, but she couldn't stop herself. She grabbed Daniel, and she kissed him. She expected him to stop her, but instead he swooped her into his arms and kissed her back, hard and passionately, responding with such intensity that she felt the way she did when they were flying, though she knew her feet were planted on the ground. For a moment, the audience was silent. Then they began to holler and jeer. Someone threw a shoe at Daniel, but he ignored it. His kisses told Luce that he believed her, that he understood the depth of her love, but she wanted to be absolutely sure. "I will always love you, Daniel." Only that didn't seem quite right, or not quite enough. She had to make him understand, and damn the consequences. If she changed history, so be it. "I'll always choose you." Yes, that was the word. "Every single lifetime I'll choose you, just as you've always chosen me. Forever." His lips parted. Did he believe her? Did he already know? It was a choice, a long-standing, deep-seated choice that reached beyond anything else Luce was capable of. Something powerful was behind it. Something beautiful and... Shadows began to swirl in the rigging overhead. Heat quaked through her body, making her convulse, desperate for the fiery release she knew was coming. Daniel's eyes flashed with pain.
"No," he whispered. "Please don't go yet."
Somehow, it always took both of them by surprise. As her past self's body erupted into flames, there was a sound of cannon fire, but Luce couldn't be sure. Her eyes went blurry with brightness, and she was cast far up and out of Lucinda's body, into the air, into darkness.
"No,"
she cried, as the walls of the announcer closed around her. Too late.
"What's the problem now?" Bill asked.
"I wasn't ready. I know Lucinda had to die, but I was just..."
She'd been on the brink of understanding something about the choice she'd made to love Daniel. And now everything about those last moments with Daniel had gone up in flames, along with her past self.
"Well, there's not much more to see," Bill said. "Just the usual routine of a building catching fire. Smoke, walls of flame, people screaming and stampeding toward the exits, trampling the less fortunate underfoot. You get the picture. The globe burned to the ground."
"What?" she said, feeling sick. "I started the fire at the globe?"
Surely burning down the most famous theater in English history would have repercussions across time.
"Oh, don't get all self-important. It was going to happen anyway. If you hadn't burst into flames, the cannon on stage would have misfired and taken the whole place out.
This is so much bigger than me and Daniel. All those people.
Look, Mother Teresa, no one died that night, besides you. No one else even got hurt. Remember that drunk leering at you from the third row? His pants catch on fire. That's the worst of it. Feel better?
Not really. Not at all.
How about this? You're not here to add to your mountain of guilt, or to change the past. There's a script, and you have your entrances and your exits.
I wasn't ready for my exit.
Why not? Henry VIII sucks anyway.
I wanted to give Daniel hope. I wanted him to know that I would always choose him, always love him. But Lucinda died before I could be sure he understood.
She closed her eyes.
His half of our curse is so much worse than mine.
That's good, Luce.
What do you mean? That's horrible.
I mean that little gem that, wow, Daniel's agony is infinitely more horrible than mine. That's what you learned here. The more you understand, the closer you'll get to knowing the root of the curse, and the more likely it is that you'll eventually find your way out of it. Right?
I don't know.
I do. Now come on, you've got bigger roles to play.
Daniel's side of the curse was worse. Luce could see that now very clearly. But what did it mean? She didn't feel any closer to being able to break it. The answer eluded her. But she knew Bill was right about one thing. She could do nothing more in this lifetime. All she could do was keep going back. 14. The Steep Slope, Central Greenland, Winter, 1100. The sky was black when Daniel stepped through. Behind him, the portal billowed in the wind like a tattered curtain, snagging and tearing itself apart before falling to pieces on the night-blue snow. A chill crept over his body. At first sight, there seemed to be nothing here at all, nothing but Arctic nights that seemed to go on forever, offering only the thinnest glimpse of day at the end. He remembered now. These fjords were the place where he and his fellow fallen angels held their meetings, all bleak dimness and harsh cold, a 2 days' trek north of the mortal settlement of Bretalio. But he would not find her here. This land had never been a part of Lucinda's past, so there would be nothing in her announcers to bring her here now. Just Daniel and the others. He shivered and marched across the snow-swept fjord toward a warm glow on the horizon. 7 of them were gathered around the bright orange fire. From a distance, the circle of their wings looked like a giant halo on the snow. Daniel didn't have to count their shining outlines to know they were all there. None of them noticed him crossing the snow toward their assembly. They always kept a single star shot on hand, just in case, but the idea of an uninvited visitor happening upon their council was so implausible it was not even a real threat. Besides, they were too busy bickering among themselves to detect the anachronism crouching behind a frozen boulder, eavesdropping.
This was a waste of time.
Gabby's voice was the first one Daniel could make out.
We're not going to get anywhere.
Gabby's patience could be a short-fused thing. At the start of the war, her rebellion had lasted a split second compared to Daniel's. Ever since then, her commitment to her side had run deep. She was back in the graces of heaven, and Daniel's hesitation went against everything she believed in. As she paced the perimeter of the fire, the tips of her huge, feathered white wings dragged in the snow behind her.
"You're the one who called this meeting," a low voice reminded her. "Now you want to adjourn?"
Roland was seated on a short black log a few feet in front of where Daniel crouched behind a boulder. Roland's hair was long and unkempt. His dark profile and his marbled gold-black wings glittered like embers in the dusk of a fire. It was all just as Daniel remembered.
"The meeting I called was for them."
Gabby stopped pacing and tossed her wings to point at the two angels sitting next to each other across the fire from Roland. Arian's slender, iridescent wings were still for once, rising high above her shoulder blades.
Their shimmer looked almost phosphorescent in the colorless night, but everything else about Arion, from her short black bob to her pale drawn lips, looked harrowingly somber and sedate. The angel beside Arion was quieter than usual, too. Annabelle stared blankly into the far reaches of the night. Her wings were dark silver, almost pewter-colored. They were broad and muscular, stretching around her and Arion in a wide, protective arc. It had been a long time since Daniel had seen her. Gabby came to a stop behind Arion and Annabelle and stood facing the other side, Roland, Molly, and Cam, who were sharing a coarse fur blanket. It was draped over their wings. Unlike the angels on the other side of the fire, the demons were shivering.
"We didn't expect your side tonight," Gabby told them. "Nor are we happy to see you."
"We have a stake in this, too," Molly said roughly.
"Not in the same way we do," Arion said. "Daniel will never join you."
If Daniel hadn't recalled where he'd sat at this meeting over 1,000 years before, he might have overlooked his earlier self entirely. That earlier self was sitting alone, in the center of the group, directly on the other side of the boulder. Behind the rock, Daniel shifted to get a better view. His earlier self's wings bloomed out behind him, great white sails as still as the night. As the others talked about him as if he weren't there, Daniel behaved as if he were alone in the world. He tossed fistfuls of snow into the fire, watching the frozen clumps hiss and dissolve into steam.
"Oh, really?" Molly said. "Care to explain why he's inching closer to our side every lifetime? That little cursing god bit he does whenever Luce explodes? I doubt it goes over so well upstairs."
"He's in agony," Annabelle shouted at Molly. "You wouldn't understand because you don't know how to love."
She scooted nearer to Daniel, the tips of her wings dragging in the snow, and addressed him directly.
"Those are just temporary blips. We all know your soul is pure. If you wanted to at last choose a side, to choose us, Daniel, if at any moment..."
"No."
The clean finality of the word pushed Annabelle away as quickly as if Daniel had drawn a weapon. Daniel's earlier self would not look at any of them. And behind the boulder, watching them, Daniel remembered what had happened during this council and shuddered at the forbidden horror of the memory.
"If you won't join them," Roland said to Daniel, "why not join us? From what I can tell, there is no worse hell than what you put yourself through every time you lose her."
"Oh, cheap shot, Roland," Arion said. "You don't even mean that. You can't believe..."
She wrung her hands.
"You're only saying that to provoke me."
Behind Arion, Gabby rested a hand on her shoulder. Their wingtips touched, flashing a bright burst of silver between them.
"What Arion means is that hell is never a better alternative, no matter how terrible Daniel's pain may be. There is only one place for Daniel. There is only one place for all of us. You see how penitent the outcasts are."
"Spare us the preaching, will ya?" Molly said. "There's a choir up there that might be interested in your brainwashing, but I'm not, and I don't think Daniel is either."
The angels and demons all turned to stare at him together, as if they were still part of the host. 7 pairs of wings casting a glowing aura of silver-gold light. 7 souls he knew as well as his own. Even behind his boulder, Daniel felt suffocated. He remembered this moment. They demanded so much of him, when he was so weakened by his broken heart. He felt the assault of Gabby's plea for him to join with heaven all over again. Roland's, too, to join with hell. Daniel felt again the shape of the one word he had spoken at the meeting, like a strange ghost in his mouth. No. Slowly, with a sick feeling creeping over him, Daniel remembered one more thing. That no? He hadn't meant it. In that moment, Daniel had been on the verge of saying yes. This was the night he'd almost given up. Now his shoulders burned. The sudden urge to let his wings out almost brought him to his knees. His insides roiled with shame-filled horror. It was rising in him, the temptation he'd fought so long to repress. In the circle around the fire, Daniel's past self looked at Cam.
"You're unusually quiet tonight." Cam didn't answer right away.
What would you have me say?
You faced this problem once. You know. And what would you have me say? Daniel sucked in his breath. Something charming and persuasive.
Annabelle snorted.
Or something underhanded and absolutely evil.
Everyone waited. Daniel wanted to burst forth from behind the rock, to rip his past self away from here. But he couldn't. His announcer had brought him here for a reason. He had to go through the whole thing again.
You're trapped, Cam said at last. You think because there was once a beginning, and because you're somewhere in the middle now, that there is going to be an end. But our world isn't rooted in teleology. It's chaos.
Our world is not the same as yours, Gabby started to say.
There's no way out of this cycle, Daniel, Cam went on. She can't break it, and neither can you. Pick heaven, pick hell, I don't really care, and you don't either. It won't make any difference.
Enough! Gabby's voice was breaking. It will make a difference. If Daniel comes home to the place he belongs, then Lucinda...
But she couldn't go on. The words were blasphemy to speak, and Gabby wouldn't do it. She fell to her knees in the snow. Behind the rock, Daniel watched his earlier self extend a hand to Gabby and raise her from the ground. He watched it play out before his eyes now, just as he remembered. He gazed into her soul and saw how brightly it burned. He glanced back and saw the others, Cam and Roland, Arian and Annabelle, even Molly, and he thought about how long he dragged the whole lot of them through his epic tragedy. And for what? Lucinda. And the choice the two of them had made long ago, and over again, to put their love above everything else. That night on the fjords, her soul was between incarnations, newly purged from her last body. What if he stopped seeking her out? Daniel was tired to his core. He didn't know if he had it in him anymore. Watching his earlier struggle, sensing the imminent arrival of absolute breakdown, Daniel recalled what he had to do. It was dangerous, forbidden, but it was absolutely necessary. Now, at least, he understood why his future self had taken him that long-ago night, to lend him strength, to keep him pure. He had weakened at this key moment in his past, and future Daniel could not let that weakness be magnified across the span of history, could not let it corrupt his and Lucinda's chances. So he repeated what had happened to him 900 years before. He would make amends tonight by joining with, no, overriding his past. Cleaving. It was the only way. He rolled back his shoulders, unleashed his trembling wings into the darkness. He could feel them catch the wind at his back. An aura of light painted the sky 100 feet above him. It was bright enough to blind a mortal, bright enough to catch the attention of 7 squabbling angels. Commotion from the other side of the boulder, shouting and gasps and the beat of wings coming closer. Daniel propelled himself off the ground, flying fast and hard, so that he soared over the boulder just as Cam came around behind it. They missed each other by a wingspan, but Daniel kept moving, swooping down upon his past self as fast as his love for Luce could take him. His past self drew back and held out his hands, warding Daniel off. All the angels knew the risks of cleaving. Once joined, it was nearly impossible to free oneself from one's past self, to separate the two lives that had been cloven together. But Daniel knew he'd been cloven in the past and had survived, so he had to do it. He was doing it to help Luce. He pressed his wings together and dove down at his past self, striking so hard he should have been crushed if he hadn't been absorbed. He shuddered, and his past self shuddered, and Daniel clamped his eyes shut and gritted his teeth to withstand the strange, sharp sickness that flooded his body. He felt as if he were tumbling down a hill, reckless and unstoppable. No way back up until he hit the bottom. Then, all at once, everything came to a stop. Daniel opened his eyes and could hear only his breathing. He felt tired but alert. The others were staring at him. He couldn't be sure whether they had any idea what had just happened. They all looked afraid to come near him,
even to speak to him. He spread his wings and spun in a full circle, tilting his head toward the sky.
"I choose my love for Lucinda,"
he called to heaven and earth, to the angels all around him and the ones who weren't there, to the soul of the one true thing he loved the most, wherever she was.
"I now reaffirm my choice. I choose Lucinda over everything, and I will until the end."
15. The Sacrifice. Chichen Itza, Mesoamerica, 5 YAB, approximately December 20, 555 CE. The announcer spat loose into the swelter of a summer day. Beneath her feet, the ground was parched, all cracked earth and tawny, dried-up blades of grass. The sky was barren blue, not a single cloud to promise rain. Even the wind seemed thirsty. She stood in the center of a flat field bordered on three sides by a strange, high wall. From this distance, it looked a little like a mosaic made of giant beads. They were irregularly shaped, not spherical exactly, ranging in color from ivory to light brown. Here and there were tiny cracks between the beads, letting in light from the other side. Besides a half-dozen vultures cawing as they swooped in listless circles, no one else was around. The wind blew hotly through her hair and smelled like... She couldn't place the smell, but it tasted metallic, almost rusty. The heavy gown she had been wearing since the ball at Versailles was soaked with sweat. It stank of smoke and ash and perspiration every time she breathed in. It had to go. She struggled to reach the laces and buttons. She could use a hand, even a tiny stone one. Where was Bill, anyway? He was always disappearing. Sometimes Luce got the feeling the gargoyle had an agenda of his own, and that she was being shuffled forward according to his schedule. She wrestled with the dress, tearing at the green lace around the collar, popping hooks as she walked. Thankfully, there was no one around to see. Finally, she got down on her knees and shimmied free, pulling the skirts over her head. As she sat back on her heels in her thin cotton shift, it hit Luce how exhausted she was. How long had it been since she'd slept? She stumbled toward the shade of the wall, her feet rustling through the brittle grass, thinking maybe she could lie down for a little while and close her eyes. Her eyelids fluttered, so sleepy. Then they shot open, and her skin began to crawl. Heads. Luce finally realized what the wall was made of. The bone-colored palisades, halfway innocent-looking from afar, were interlocking racks of impaled human heads. She stifled a scream. Suddenly, she could place the odor being carried in the wind. It was the stench of rot and spilled blood, of putrefying flesh. Along the bottom of the palisades were sun-bleached, weathered skulls, whipped white and clean by the wind and the sun. Along the top, the skulls looked fresher. That is, they were still clearly people's heads, thick manes of black hair, skin mostly intact. But the skulls in the middle were someplace between mortal and monster. The frayed skin was peeling back, leaving dried brown blood on bone. The faces were stretched tight, with what might have been terror or rage. Luce staggered away, hoping for a breath of air that didn't stink of rot, but not finding it.
"It's not quite as gruesome as it looks."
She whirled around, terrified. But it was only Bill.
"Where were you? Where are we?"
"It's actually a great honor to get staked out like this," he said, marching right up to the next to lowest row.
He looked one head in the eye.
"All these innocent little lambs go straight to heaven. Just what the faithful desire."
"Why did you leave me here with these—"
"Ah, come on. They won't bite."
He eyed her sidelong.
"What have you done with your clothes?"
Luce shrugged.
"It's hot."
He sighed lengthily, with a put-upon world weariness.
"Now ask me where I've been. And this time, try to keep the judgment out of your voice."
Her mouth twitched. There was something sketchy about Bill's occasional disappearances, but he was standing there now, with his little claws tucked neatly behind his back, giving her an innocent smile. She sighed.
"Where have you been?"
"Shopping."
Bill gleefully extended both his wings,
revealing a light brown wraparound skirt hanging off one wingtip and a short matching tunic hanging off the other.
"And the coup de grâce,"
he said, withdrawing from behind his back a chunky white necklace. Bone. She took the tunic and the skirt, but waved off the necklace. She'd seen enough bone.
"No, thanks." "Do you want to blend in? Then you've got to wear the goods."
Swallowing her disgust, she slipped it over her head. The polished bone pieces had been strung along some kind of fiber. The necklace was long and heavy and, Luce had to admit, sort of pretty.
"And I think this," he gave her a painted metal band, "goes in your hair."
"Where did you get all this stuff?" she asked.
"It's yours. I mean, it's not yours, Lucinda Price, but it is yours in a larger cosmic sense. It belongs to the you that is part of this lifetime, Ishkuat."
"Ish who?"
"Ishkuat. Your name in this life meant little snake."
Bill watched her face change.
"It was a term of endearment in the Mayan culture. Sort of."
"The same way getting your head impaled on a stick was an honor?" Bill rolled his stone eyes.
"Stop being so ethnocentric. That means thinking your own culture is superior to other cultures."
"I know what it means," she said, working the band into her dirty hair. "But I'm not being superior. I just don't think having my head stuck on one of these racks would be so great." There was a faint thrumming in the air, like faraway drum beats.
"That's exactly the sort of thing Ishkuat would say. You always were a little bit backward."
"What do you mean?"
"See, you, Ishkuat, were born during the Wayeb, which are these 5 odd days at the end of the Mayan year that everyone gets real superstitious about because they don't fit into the calendar. Kind of like leap year days. It's not exactly lucky to be born during Wayeb. So no one was shocked when you grew up to be an old maid."
"Old maid?" Luce asked. "I thought I never lived past 17, more or less."
17 here in Chichen Itza is ancient," Bill said, floating from head to head, his wings humming as they fluttered. "But it's true. You never used to live much past 17 or thereabouts. It's been kind of a mystery as to why, in the lifetime of Lucinda Price, you've managed to stick around so long."
"Daniel said it was because I wasn't baptized." Now Luce was sure she heard drums, and that they were drawing closer. "But how can that matter? I mean, I bet Ishka, whatever, was baptized." Bill flapped his hand dismissively.
"Baptism is just one word for a kind of sacrament or covenant in which your soul is more or less claimed. Just about every faith has something similar. Christianity, Judaism, Islam, even the Mayan religion that is about to go marching past."
He nodded toward the drumming, which was now so loud that Luce wondered if they should hide.
"They all feature sacraments of some kind, in which one expresses one's devotion to one's god."
"So I'm alive in my current life in Thunderbolt because my parents didn't have me baptized?"
"No," Bill said. "You're able to be killed in your current life in Thunderbolt because your parents didn't have you baptized. You're alive in your current life because, well, no one really knows why."
There must have been a reason. Maybe it was the loophole Daniel had spoken about in the hospital in Milan. But even he didn't seem to understand how Luce was able to travel through the announcers. With every life she visited, Luce could feel herself getting closer to fitting the pieces of her past together. But she wasn't there yet.
"Where's the village?" she asked. "Where are the people? Where's Daniel?"
The drums grew so loud that she had to raise her voice.
"Oh," Bill said. "They're on the other side of the Zompantlis."
"The what?"
"This wall of heads. Come on, you've got to see this."
Through the open spaces in the racks of skulls, flashes of color danced. Bill herded Luce to the edge of the skull wall and gestured for her to look. Beyond the wall, a whole civilization paraded past. A long line of people danced and beat their feet against a broad, packed dirt road that wound through the boneyard. They had silky black hair and skin the color of chestnuts. They ranged in age from 3 to old enough to defy guessing. All of them were vibrant and beautiful and strange.
Their clothes were sparse, weathered animal hides that barely covered their flesh, showing off tattoos and painted faces. It was the most remarkable body art, elaborate, colorful depictions of brightly feathered birds, suns, and geometric designs splayed across their backs and arms and chests. In the distance there were buildings, an orderly grid of bleached stone structures, and a cluster of smaller buildings with flat thatched roofs. Beyond that there was jungle, but the leaves of its trees looked withered and brittle. The crowd marched past, blind to Luce, caught up in the frenzy of their dance.
"Come on!"
Bill said, and shoved her out into the flow of people.
"What?" she shouted. "Go in there? With them?"
"It'll be fun," Bill cackled, flying ahead. "You know how to dance, don't you?"
Cautiously at first, she and the little gargoyle joined the parade, as they passed through what looked like a marketplace, a long, narrow strip of land packed with wooden casks and bowls full of goods for sale, dimply black avocados, deep red stalks of maize, dried herbs bundled with twine, and many other things Luce didn't recognize. She turned her head this way and that to see as much as possible as she passed, but there was no way to stop. The surge of the crowd pushed her inexorably forward. The Mayans followed the road as it curved down onto a wide, shallow plain. The roar of their dance faded, and they gathered quietly, murmuring to one another. They numbered in the hundreds. At the repeated pressure of Bill's sharp claws on her shoulders, Luce lowered herself to her knees like the rest of them and followed the crowd's gaze upward. Behind the marketplace, one building rose higher than all the others, a stepped pyramid of the whitest stone. The two sides visible to Luce each had steep staircases running up their centers that ended at a single-story structure painted blue and red. A shiver ran through Luce, part recognition and part inexplicable fear. She'd seen this pyramid before. In history book pictures, the Mayan temple had fallen to ruins. But it was far from ruins now. It was magnificent. Four men holding drums made of wood and stretched hide stood in a row on the ledge around the pyramid's top. Their tanned faces were painted with strokes of red, yellow, and blue to look like masks. Their drums beat in unison, faster and faster, until someone emerged from the doorway. The man was taller than the drummers. Beneath the towering red and white feathered headdress, his entire face was painted with maze-like turquoise designs. His neck, wrists, ankles, and earlobes were adorned with the same kind of bone jewelry Bill had given Luce to wear. He was carrying something, a long stick decorated with painted feathers and shiny shards of white. At one end, something silver gleamed. When he faced the people, the crowd fell silent, almost as if by magic.
"Who is that man?" Luce whispered to Bill. "What's he doing?"
"That's the tribal leader, Zots. Pretty haggard, right? Times are tough when your people haven't seen rain for 364 days. Not that they're counting on that stone calendar over there or anything."
He pointed at a gray slab of rock marked with hundreds of sooty black lines. "Not one drop of water for almost an entire year?" Luce could almost feel the thirst coming off the crowd.
"They're dying," she said.
"They hope not. That's where you come in," Bill said. "You and a few other unfortunate wretches. Daniel, too. He's got a minor role. Chat's very hungry by now, so it's really all hands on deck."
"Chat?"
"The rain god. The Mayans have this absurd belief that a wrathful god's favorite food is blood. See where I'm going with this?"
"Human sacrifice," Luce said slowly.
"Yep. This is the beginning of a long day of 'em. More skulls to add to the racks. Exciting, isn't it?"
"Where's Lucinda? I mean, Ishkuat?"
Bill pointed at the temple.
"She's locked up in there, along with the other sacrificees, waiting for the ball game to be over."
"The ball game?"
"That's what this crowd is on their way to watch. See, the tribal leader likes to host a ball game before a big sacrifice."
Bill coughed and brushed his wings back.
"It's kind of a cross between basketball and soccer. If each team had only two players, and the ball weighed a ton, and the losers got their heads cut off and their blood fed to Chat,
To the court!
Zots bellowed from the top step of the temple. The Mayan words sounded strangely guttural, and yet were still comprehensible to Luz. She wondered how they made Ishkuat feel, locked up in the room behind Zots. A great cheer erupted from the crowd. As a group, the Mayans rose and broke into a run toward what looked like a large stone amphitheater at the far side of the plain. It was oblong and low, a brown dirt playing field ringed by tiered stone bleachers.
Ah, there's our boy!
Bill pointed at the head of the crowd as they neared the stadium. A lean, muscular boy was running, faster than the others, his back to Luz. His hair was dark brown and shiny, his shoulders deeply tanned and painted with intersecting red and black bands. When he turned his head slightly to the left, Luz caught a quick glimpse of his profile. He was nothing like the Daniel she'd left in her parents' backyard. And yet...
Daniel, Luz said. He looks...
different and also precisely the same, Bill asked.
Yes.
That's his soul, you recognize. Regardless of how you two may look on the outside, you'll always know each other's souls.
It hadn't occurred to Luz until now how remarkable it was that she recognized Daniel in every